Hello and welcome to Buffalo Who Knew podcast series, which highlights the underappreciated, sometimes unearthed assets of Buffalo, a city which we're all growing to love more with each passing day. I'm here with Noel Nussbaumer and our guest, the esteemed Frank Kowski, who's an incredibly talented and knowledgeable and generous architectural historian who resides in Buffalo Hill. Frank?
Hello, Fritz.
So, thank you for taking time to speak with us today. And, you know, why we thought it would be great to have you on the program today is you really have become somewhat of the de facto expert on Olmsted. Is that accurate? Is that a fair statement?
Yes.
Okay, so for those who...
Now, is that de facto for Buffalo, or is that de facto in, like, really in a larger breath?
Well, I have to say I'm known beyond the borders of Buffalo.
Yeah.
So writing about Olmsted and Calvert Falls, others of there, Richardson, and around that circle.
How did you come to gather such a, you know, incredible knowledge and learn so much about these important individuals?
Well, I started out as a graduate student at Johns Hopkins getting my PhD, and I wrote about, I was interested in the Victorian period. There was a professor there who was very, I guess you'd say, pioneering the studies of mid-19th and late 19th century American architecture, Phoebe Stanton. I was one of her students, and so I did my dissertation on Frederick Clark Withers, who was an important British architect, came to America about 1851, and he was in the circle of Andrew Jackson Downing, Calvert Vaux, and then later Frederick Law Olmsted. And so I got into that, into the swim, you might say, of those people and that history, and I never stopped.
Never looked back.
Yeah.
Well, we're all the beneficiaries of that work. So tell us more about you. Are you from Buffalo originally?
No, I grew up in Washington, D.C., and I studied at George Washington University, and then I got my Ph.D. at Johns Hopkins in Baltimore, and I came here to teach at Buffalo State College. I taught art history for many years. I'm retired now. I lived in New York for a while, New York City. And I got married there. Unfortunately, my wife died a couple years ago. She was Swiss from Geneva, and so I was sort of my second city is Geneva, or my third city, I guess. Hmm. I spent a lot of time there.
Not a bad place to spend time. So let's talk about Olmsted. You know, obviously, for those who are not in Buffalo, from Buffalo, Olmsted has had a major impact on this city. So let's talk a little bit about, many of us know what he accomplished in, well, Olmsted and Box accomplished in New York with designing both Central Park and then Park Slope, which were considered the two great, I can't remember the term you used at a recent session I heard of you, where you, was it called the pastoral or country park.
Country park.
Country park.
Yes.
So they designed these major country parks in New York City, and then they came to Buffalo. So tell us a little bit more about how he got here.
Well, Olmsted started his career as a landscape architect on Central Park. In fact, he was invited to join by Calvert Vaux in preparation of what came to be called the Greenspark Plan. It was the competition entry they prepared in 1857-58 and won, and that became the basis for the Central Park, which is the first big municipal park in America. So it was often used as an example by other cities to follow. And the second city was Brooklyn, across the river there. And Olmsted and Vaux designed Brooklyn's Prospect Park in 1865. And then 3 years later, because of a man named William Dorsheimer here in Buffalo, he was a promoter of the idea of Buffalo, which was a growing city, of course, having its version of Central Park and Prospect Park here. And he's responsible for writing to Olmsted and Vaux to asked them to come and give their opinion about where a park of that scale could be created here in Buffalo. Olmsted came in August of 1868. He came by himself because Fawkes was off in Europe at the time. So the conception of the Buffalo Park system, as it came to be called, was really Olmsted's. And then when Fawkes came back, the two of them worked up the plan and the details. But it was Olmsted's visit in August of 68 that started the whole ball rolling.
So in addition, it sounds like there's another interesting factoid about Olmsted and his relationship to Buffalo, which sounds like it might have been one of the earliest planned neighborhoods that he got involved with.
Yes, it came to be called Parkside. It was after he parted with Fawkes, he came back in the early 1870s, and a group of investors were interested in creating a residential neighborhood around the park, around Delaware Park. And he laid out a plan of curvy roads and tree-lined streets that would be entirely residential, no commercial traffic or no commercial buildings. And this was something new in America. His model was a suburb outside of Chicago called Riverside that he and Boss had designed in 1868. So Parkside was maybe the second important residential suburb in America, with elaborate curving streets. Now, when it was finally laid out in the 1880s, the streets were modified and the lots were a little smaller than he had planned, but basically it's his idea. And I always like to think that when Frank Lloyd Wright came to Buffalo and he was asked by Darwin Martin to design his house, Martin had bought a property on Oakland Place, which was, you know, highfalutin, and Delaware Avenue also would have been a place for a person of his stature normally build a house. But Wright convinced him that this lot at the corner of Summit and Jewett was where he should build the house. And I think, I don't know whether Wright knew this was an Olmsted neighborhood, but he just must have sensed that, like Oak Park, this is the kind of place that I want to build my house, not somewhere down on Delaware Avenue or Oakland Place where all these other kinds of traditional mansions. Mm-hmm. Plus, Martin had already lived in that neighborhood.
And I think it's really important to highlight that, yes, beyond the natural beauty that Olmsted and Bucks were gravitating towards, there were really a lot of social principles there too, weren't there? Weren't they thinking about these spaces for public use, for bringing the public together in sort of a convening location? Is that accurate?
Yes, that's true. Fawkes was more of he considered himself the artist, the landscape architect and architect. He also had another side to his career. Olmsted was both a designer, but he also was a kind of social philosopher, and he was very interested in social issues. And he thought that the parks had an additional role to play in American life. He was very concerned, and Fawkes too, to a certain degree, about the way America was becoming stratified between the very rich and then everybody else. And this was, he thought, was corrosive to democracy. And the public parks were a way of sort of creating a level field where everyone would come together on an equal basis, whether you were rich or poor or middle class, educated or uneducated. And this was a role that the parks were going to play, democratic socializing. Sometimes referred to it as. And he also thought that the parks, especially these country parks, as they call them, that kind of imitated a rural landscape, would be a kind of calming and elevating influence on people that were working in American cities. The cities were very much more congested and dirty and gruesome. And so parks that they were going to create were kind of a safety valve to get people who couldn't leave for vacations and things to go to a public park and have a recreation, either passive or active. And He also thought that this would be a way of raising the level of civilization amongst a lot of immigrants and people that came from different traditions than his old New England stock. And he wanted to, I guess we'd say, it was part of the process of the Americanization of immigrant populations, and then after the Civil War, the freed African Americans.
Wow, incredible. How prescient.
It's incredible to think that to this day and age, I mean, how important that is, in all of our lives, and how that didn't exist before then, and it's something today that we take so much for granted.
Yes, it's true. Well, because of that era, and largely because of Olmsted's proselytizing for these ideas, yes.
So Dorsheimer and other business leaders convinced Olmsted to come to Buffalo and lay out a park modeled after, you know, Central Park. And
well, that was their idea. And when Olmsted came, he had a tour of the area. He was on his way to Chicago. Olmsted and Voss had taken on a Chicago commission and to design a suburb called Riverside, the first residential suburb in America, to say, at least of any extent. And so he stopped here on his way. And when he was taken around, people had sort of ideas about where there should be a big park. It was in the northern part of the city, away from the lake. But he saw everything and he said, no, wait, there's so much empty land and you have so much opportunity here. You should have more than one park. You could have three parks. And this is an idea he'd been thinking about, he and Box, earlier than this, but they could implement that here. And these parks would have different forms of recreation. They were all in Central Park, everything had to be sort of squished together. But here, he said, you've got the luxury of having so much area undeveloped. You can have one park that would be like Central Park, a country park, that's what became Delaware Park. Another park that would be more directly for active sports and democratic socializing, that came to be called the Parade. It's today Martin Luther King Jr. Park. And then on the west side, he said, here's an opportunity to have something that allows people to have access to the waterfront here in Buffalo, recreation and scenic preservation, as he would have referred to it, and that was the front. So those were the three. And then he wanted to join them together in a system of parkways, long, we call them linear parks, actually. So you could ride from, say, you start out at Front Park on the west side and went over to the Parade on the east side. It was about 6 miles of city streets, but they were going to be shaded by trees and they would be very, only residential streets. And so you have this sort of, this green lungs of the city, as it came to be later called.
And had he done that before, or was that a first?
This is the first city to take him up on this idea. They proposed it for other places, not as extensive as here in Buffalo, but this is the first time.
Did the radial street grid have anything to do with that?
Yes, he was great. He really respected the original Ellicott plan, and which was unusual for an American city. It's like Washington, it's French in its origin. And he thought what he was doing was completing or extending Ellicott's plan inland. It's the only place the city could grow, of course, but that's what he was doing. And all of his parkways and parks were connected to other streets that already were radiating from Niagara Square. And in particular, that's when Delaware Avenue became the street of wealth and influence. That was going to be extended as the connector between the old city of Niagara Square and the new park, 3 miles away, Delaware Park.
And of course, there's the famous quote that Olmsted made about Buffalo being
the best planned city in the world. That's what he said. And he believed that, obviously. He and Vaux had completed the work. The city was very fast in building on the ground the parks and the parkways. By 1876, this was really 6 years, because by the time they worked up the plan and it was adopted, it was 1870. So And the city wanted to get this done by the centennial year. That was going to be a big deal for the whole country, 100th anniversary of the American Revolution. And they did it. And in 1876, there was a great, the first World's Fair to be held in the United States in Philadelphia, the Centennial Exhibition. In fact, Vaux is going to design a great pavilion to house it. But at that exposition, Olmsted exhibited a map of Buffalo, and that's where he made the statement that it was the best planned city in the world as to its grounds and so forth. That's how proud he was of it. And he had a map and a long descriptive text. And then 2 years later, he sent the same exhibit to Paris. There was a World's Fair in Paris in 1878. And he sent that same display, which is really quite extraordinary when you think about it, because Paris was the city that had started the whole urban renewal movement in 1850 when Baron Haussmann had taken on modernizing Paris, and it was considered, that's when Paris became the great cosmopolitan city of the world. And so to show the Parisians that here there's an American city, Buffalo, that might even be better than Paris and called the best planned city in the world. So it's quite a coup.
So that might be our factoid about who knew that Buffalo actually influenced Paris.
Well, it actually did influence, by then Paris was done, but it did influence some other European cities, actually.
That's extraordinary. Mm-hmm. So, needless to say, this had an incredible impact on Buffalo from the get-go. That I assume the city really embraced it.
Yeah.
And fast forward, my understanding is that after Olmsted Sr. passed away, his sons took over the business, correct?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And they continued to deepen their involvement with Buffalo, and then three more parks were added to our portfolio, correct?
Well, the last one was designed by his firm, his sons, it was called Olmsted Brothers, and that's Riverside Park up on the Niagara River. There wasn't a park on the river per se, and that was 1898. Olmsted retired in 1895, and his work was carried on by his son. So that was the very last public park that the firm did. But then earlier on, in the late 1880s and early 1890s, they added, actually Sr. was involved with this, South Park and Cazenovia Park. The plan originally, Olmsted had planned a fantastic landscape park along the Lake Erie shore, where eventually Bethlehem Steel went in, and that was going to have balloon ascents. There were going to be little islands and lagoons that people could drink for private parties, all kinds of, there were going to be electric lights run by windmills, they were going to be called dynamos. But the city said that this was going to be too expensive. And they were worried, too, at that time, the Great Wall, I guess, hadn't extended down there, and Butlowen storms on the lake would just wash in, although he claimed that he was going to design it in such a way that it wouldn't. But anyway, that park, which came to be called South Park, was then built instead of on the lake, where it is today, further inland, and then Cazenovia Park, even a little further, instead of having a lakefront park. He was very disappointed, as were many people in Buffalo. They still got too nice parks.
Where was Vaux during this whole time period?
Well, Vaux was with Olmsted until 1872, and then they split up. So these later parks were entirely Olmsted. The two of them came back to work together in the mid-1880s, and they designed what came to be called the Niagara Reservation. Once the state had finally bought the land to preserve Niagara Falls, the two men came back together. They were special. They were considered the two greatest landscape architects in the country at the time, and they designed a general plan for the reservation, and they worked together on that. It was finished in 1887. And they did one later park together down in Newburgh, New York, that was in honor of Andrew Jackson Downing, who was the first landscape architect in America. Morrison Boss had worked with him originally.
Another collaboration, which I think is important to mention, is Olmsted's connection to Richardson, correct?
I mean, yes.
And so we have a site in Buffalo, the A.J. Richardson campus, which we've done a segment on previously, which was one of Richardson's largest commissions. But my mm-hmm. understanding is that he very specifically collaborated or requested Olmsted to be part of that campus.
Well, yes. Actually, it was through Dorsheimer that Olmsted and Richardson really came to be collaborators and lifelong friends. When Olmsted was here in 1868, that same year, Dorsheimer commissioned the young H.H. Richardson to design his house on Delaware Avenue. Richardson was the second American architect to study in Paris, and he'd just come back 3 years after the Civil War, 3 years before this. And we just generally think that Olmsted might have said something to Dorsheimer. I have a young friend who's an architect, and if you want something very up-to-date and Parisian, you can hire him. And he did. It is like a Parisian villa that's stuck on Delaware Avenue. And after that, the three of them became very close friends and worked together at the state capitol in Albany. They worked for the Dorsheimer who pushed the legislation for the Niagara Reservation through the New York legislature, and they were all very, very close. Vaux had gone, they'd split in 1872, and after that, Richardson sort of became Olmsted's close architectural, not collaborator, but they did work together, but not on, well, on buildings where Olmsted would design the landscape and Richardson would design the building, whereas with Vaux, they were collaborating on the landscape together, and then Vaux would, if there were buildings involved, he would add them, he would design them. But
they were both on the same page with the whole therapeutic angle too.
Yes. So the state hospital, which was just shortly after Richard Olmsted came, it was 1869, and then designed 1870. Again, we don't know why Richardson was asked to design it. He was very unknown. He was talented, but he didn't have a big reputation yet. And Vaux did, but it seems that then Vaux had worked on the Hudson River Hospital at Poughkeepsie, but it might have been he was just too busy, and so the job went to Richardson. And this was the first building that Richardson designed and that became known as his signature style, Richardsonian Romanesque. And Olmsted and Vaux were hired to design the landscape. The first plan for the grounds around the hospital was lost, and when they finally came around to implement or to design the landscape, they turned back to Olmsted. He was alone at that point. Vaux had gone off. So it really is Olmsted's landscape around the psychiatric building. And he did think of it as a therapeutic landscape, especially the area in front of the hospital along Forest Avenue. He wanted it to be a very simple kind of meadow with a few trees. He said he didn't think people with those kinds of problems, with the mental problems, should have something that's too complicated or decorative the way that you might find in Delaware Park. The trails are winding, all sorts of things going on. He said, you have to keep it simple for this because it's more restful. Ironically, he would end his life in an asylum in Boston, but he had actually designed the landscape for the McLean Hospital, which, in fact, he was Olmsted was instrumental in creating that building and the landscape, and apparently from what Fan used to say, he used to complain when he was a patient there, living there, that they never did what he had said they should do.
Of course.
Well, that's fascinating. So after, you know, Olmsted passes away and then, you know, the later decades, you know, that ensue aren't terribly friendly on the system in Buffalo. We, you know, tore a highway through the Humboldt Parkway, which was probably his grandest parkway
yes.
that he had designed. We put a highway through Delaware Park. We, you know, the golf courses and I think there was another park that was already removed downtown, correct?
Front Park was, you had the
Front
had the
Park
old,
has been compromised. Yeah. Maston Park is where the City Honors High School is. That was one of the first to go.
Mm-hmm.
It was a, well, not a big park. Olmsted came back in the 1880s. In 1887, the state passed a legislation to create small parks in urban settings. And Maston Park, as it was called, was one of those that he designed. And eventually the city thought that it would be cheaper to build a school there than to buy new land. And they did. But the commissioners bought it at the time, but lost, and they realized they were prophetic. They said that once this school goes in, and they would say, well, a park would still exist around the school, but they said that's not going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't. And there was another one down on Clinton Street, a small park that got obliterated.
Was Days Park, did Olmsted have a hand in Days Park?
It was already here, Days Park and Prospect Park. And he had a hand in redesigning it a bit. And Johnson Park.
Johnson Park, yeah. So, if, you know, given your expertise on the subject matter, what, you know, and luckily Buffalo has had a great steward in the Olmsted Park Conservancy since the, you know, late 70s, I believe, and they've really been
yes,
working
Mr.
very...
Yes, John Bozic, she's the one that got the whole ball rolling and it eventually became the national organization. So it's quite a flourishing one called the Olmsted Network, mm-hmm. but it started right here in Buffalo.
Amazing. Go John Bozic. Yeah.
Yes.
So we've got this incredible organization serving as a steward and doing great work.
Mm-hmm.
If there were one passion project you had to sort of reconstitute the original Olmstedian plans, what would you like to see happen?
I would like to see the Humboldt Parkway and Agassiz Circle restored to their former appearance.
Okay. Wow. I know there are a lot of people who agree with you on that.
What about Vox? What if we were to recreate one Vox architectural masterpiece, because I just love everything he ever did.
Yes.
What do you think the potential is in here in a city like Buffalo? Because they're doing it, what, in New York City?
Yes, in Central Park and Prospect Park. He designed, in my opinion, his greatest park building here in what was then the Parade, or Martin Luther King Park, called the Parade House, which was a vast structure that incorporated a dance hall, a restaurant, little theaters, all sorts of recreation that they didn't think was appropriate to be in Delaware Park and the country park. This was the real center of democratic socializing, and it was a fabulous structure that went down in the early 20th century. That would be, I think, well, at this point, virtually impossible to rebuild.
But how did it go down?
Well, at first they had a fire, it was rebuilt, and then in around 1903, 1904, it was not used very much, and I'm not sure, it didn't have a fire, but it was demolished. A portion of it, as you all may know, has been discovered by my friend Martin Washadlow on Mill Street, just outside of Martin Luther King Jr. Park. It's gotten the name the Vaux Barn, and it seems to have been a section of a shed that was attached to the parade house, used for storage of, I guess, it seems to be like a barn where there was a loft above. Anyway, it's a beautiful little structure, and that survives, and hope that we can maybe do something about preserving it and maybe bringing it back into Martin Luther King Jr. Park. But I think if you're going to start from scratch to rebuild something, the most logical one would be the Spirehead Gazebo, as it was their summer house, that stood on a little hill overlooking the lake in Delaware Park, near where they have the Shakespeare Festival.
And certainly we've got a wealth of craftspeople here in Buffalo still. So
yes,
whether it's the Buffalo Maritime Center or whatnot, there are a lot of people who, you know, were we to raise the funds for it, it would be achievable, I think. So
in New York City, did they go on a national, did they get help nationally? What was even the process there? I mean, is that something that we could do?
Well,
I
mean, New York City started, it was Betsy Rogers who began the revival of Central Park, which was in terrible shape in the 1970s, as you might remember. And she formed Central Park Conservancy. It's a private organization that works with the city to manage the historic park. And that's what the Buffalo Olmsted Parks Conservancy is modeled on in other cities as well.
So, Frank, what do you have upcoming? Are you working on any books?
A book about the third felt person who was involved with the creation of Central Park, Jacob Ray Mould, his name is Mould. And he was another British designer who came over to America shortly after Vaux. And he was a protege of a very important British architect and designer. And he came to New York. And he was a person who could dream up beautiful designs for decorations, ornaments. Owen Jones, his mentor, had written a book that's still used today for architects looking for ornamental patterns called The Grammar of Ornament. And he was kind of the American version of Owen Jones. And so I just wrote a book about him. He did all the decorative work in Central Park, and he did a couple of buildings in Central Park, especially the Tavern on the Green, but it was a sheepfold. They used to have sheep on the meadow in the park, and they'd bring them in at night there. It's fabulous to build it. So I did a book on Jacob Mould. It just came out in the summer.
What's the title?
It's called Hell on Color, Sweet on Song, Jacob Ray Mould and the Artful Beauty of Central Park, because Sweet on Song, he also had a second career as a promoter of music and in New York City. He was very much involved in early serious music in New York. In fact, he himself was an accomplished organist and used to have, chamber music evenings in his own home. So he had another kind of lifestyle. And in his architecture, he did do buildings aside from Central Park. They were very colorful, different materials. So he said at one point, I'm hell on color. So we both have a good time. Although, you know, with something like that, it gets cataloged with religious books.
Well, it sounds fascinating. I don't know anything about it.
Well, he was very interesting because he also had African ancestry, so he was mixed race. He didn't make a lot of it because in 1850 he had to be in America, and if you had any amount of black blood, you were considered black, and so he passed. I think he was one of these people that we call them, they were passing. He passed for white, and I think no one ever really suspected him. Of course, he was in New York, but at the same time, he was British educated. Well spoken. He was not the person that, you know, people might have thought he was an escaped slave.
So to round out the program today, what is there, you know, in the theme of this podcast about Buffalo Who Knew, which, you know, again is to highlight under recognized aspects of the city, is there an interesting factoid you'd like to cite other than Buffalo influencing Paris, which I think we can stop right there. But is there anything about Olmsted and his relationship to Buffalo that maybe is lesser known?
Well, he was particularly pleased about the reception of Front Park, and he wrote a letter about it a little bit later in his life, because when he first came to Buffalo and he suggested that there'd be a park on the waterfront, people said, oh, no, we don't want to be near the lake. It's cold, and it stays cold winter back, and we don't want that. But he said, no, this is an opportunity. And especially at that point, that's where Lake Erie flows into the Niagara River, which is really not a river. It's a strait between Lake Erie and Lake Ontario. And everybody knows, I'm sure, has seen it. The waters there become very turbulent. That's because the lake narrows to this little place, and all the water in the lake flows through there. And he said, you stand there and you watch that turbulence. It's something you can't see anywhere else in America. And he says, well, he's right, of course, the waters of four great lakes go by as you watch there. This is a continental place, and you should have the ability to see it and enjoy it. It's where the Peace Bridge is now, but you can still see the waters that he described very beautifully in his letter. And he came back a few years later, and people were going over there and enjoying the park and the waterfront, and he said this was vindication of what he had said.
Well, extraordinary. Thank you, Frank. This has been incredibly interesting, incredibly informative. We appreciate you taking the time to join us today.